afternoon. I would like to call this House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, January 30th, and let the record reflect that it is 1 o'clock in the afternoon, p.m. Today we have present Vice Chair Representative Allard, Representative Carpenter, Representative Groh, Representative Gray, and myself, Chair Vance. I'd like to remind the committee members and everyone present to please silence your cell phones. The staff will be assisting us today is Linda Jensen with House Records and Lisa Denny with the Juneau LIO. Thank you so much. And we now have Representative Eastman with us as well. We have one item on today's agenda. We are going to have a presentation on the operations of the Alaska court system. Members should have two sets of documents for this presentation that were emailed to you. If you don't have any, please let us know and my staff will provide them for you. I would like to invite Ms. Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, up, and she made it clear that she is well-versed in this and is willing to take questions as we move through the process, but I would like to let her kind of get the first overall intro to everything, and then we can jump in. She does a great job giving us an understanding of the court system, so I do appreciate you being able to come on short notice to help us understand the court system as a whole. So please state your name for the record, and you may begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I'd like to just sort of describe how the courts are set up and operate here in the state of Alaska. I'll move then into some of our filing statistics, what we handle, what happens with criminal cases, and then some of the other programs that we run. And as Madam Chair said, I'm open to questions at any time as the chair wishes. Okay, so first of all, the Alaska court system is one unified court system, unlike in other states. We don't have any such thing as borough courts or municipal courts or anything like that. So everything that happens within the court system is organized through one administrative office, which sits largely in Anchorage, and I'm a member of that administrative office. There are four judicial districts. There's basically the first district is Juneau and Southeast with the presiding judge in Juneau. The second is up north, and that has Kotzebue with its presiding judge. The third is South Central and then some, and that presiding judge sits in Anchorage. And the fourth is Fairbanks-Bethel type of region with a presiding judge who sits in Bethel. The presiding judges are administrative heads of those districts. They don't influence the case decisions or have authority over any of the other judges in the district except for administratively. There are two levels of trial courts. There is the district court, which is the lower level, and the superior court. The district court, we have 20 judges, and they're located in seven different places. I can get as detailed or not as you wish. I'll start, and you can ask for more. Superior court, there are 45 superior court judges, and those are in 15 different locations. The superior court is the court of general jurisdiction, meaning any civil criminal case in the state of Alaska could go to the superior court. The district court is a subset of that. And when I go through the filing chart in a little bit, you'll see a little bit more specifically what I mean and who has jurisdiction over what. If dissatisfied with a trial court decision, one can appeal. If it's a criminal appeal, it goes directly to the Court of Appeals. Our Court of Appeals has four judges on it. Thank you to the legislature for 2020 giving us a fourth Court of Appeals judge, which has been terribly effective at addressing the backlog that was occurring at that level. And I think that parties and defendants and victims have been grateful for that fourth Court of Appeals judge. That Court of Appeals only handles criminal matters. Now, it also handles things like delinquency, which you would think of as criminal, but actually isn't, and post-conviction relief, anything that's, it's best to think of it, all criminal cases and crime-related cases go to the Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court has five justices, and the Supreme Court takes appeals of right. We do not have in the state of Alaska a petition process where the Supreme Court can say, no thanks, the trial court got it right. if you have anything other than a criminal case, which will go to the Court of Appeals, whether it's a divorce, a child in need of aid, a property division, a contract dispute, out of the Superior Court, that appeal goes directly to the Supreme Court. As a result, the Supreme Court doesn't handle very many criminal cases. Those, as I said, all go to the Court of Appeals. And having said that there's not a petition process, there's a small one. So sometimes a Court of Appeals criminal case can be petitioned to the Supreme Court. Those, the Supreme Court has the ability to accept or not. But most of your criminal decisions will come out of the Court of Appeals as the final decision in the state. We also have working within the Superior and District Courts magistrate judges. We have 38 magistrate judges. They serve in the larger courts and help with the caseload, but they are critically often the only judicial officer in the small rural courts. And they sit all over the state. Some of them do a traveling circuit. And they can handle things with even more limited jurisdiction. Mostly they handle minor offenses, which are not cases involving children, but small offenses like violations, traffic, fish and game. For example, the one in Naknek does a lot of fish and game. It depends on the locations what their caseload will look like. They can do emergency type proceedings, initial arraignments, and if the parties agree, they can even handle misdemeanors. So those are our magistrate judges. As a whole, the court system takes up about 1.5% of the state budget, so we're fairly small in that regard. We have a total of 772 positions, and if you pull out those judges and magistrate judges, that leaves about 660 people who work in the trial courts, clerical staff, almost all our clerical staff with some supervisory, or in the appellate courts. I won't talk deeply about the budget, although I handle the bills for the court system. I have a colleague, Doug Willeber, and he will be coming to you during the subcommittee process with the court's budget issues. The one thing I do like to mention, though, that people might not be aware of is the court does not keep any of the money it collects and put to spend on its budget. For example, fines that are assessed that are payable at the court, filing fees, it's $250 to file a case payable at the court. All of that gets turned over to the general fund for your branch to appropriate as you deem fit. Last year, for example, the court deposited about $7.5 million into the general fund, mostly from filing fees and fines that get assessed. And I should also say there is an indigency provision so that if somebody cannot afford a filing fee, they are not denied access to the courts, and that is not terribly uncommon. State agencies don't pay a fee for a case, so that because that would just be a moving of money, and again, those indigent folks do not.
Ms. Mead, before yes. you continue. It's listed here that there were 84,475 district court cases filed in FY22. Can you help us kind of get a broader perspective? Is that a usual number of cases filed in district court, or is that higher or lower than what you would consider a usual caseload?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess that that I'll go to that chart now since you are interested. So I think you are pulling that off the colored circle graph that I provided. Is that okay? That is not abnormal. I can go through a little bit more specifically about some of those numbers if it would be helpful. So at the top of that sheet, you'll see those trial court cases combined, and you can see that about half the cases are minor offenses. Now, this is a representation of what gets filed in the court, but certainly not the court's workload. The minor offenses, as I said, are things that are usually charged on a ticket, a citation, and those come in automatedly, and they are handled in a fast manner and do not take up half the court system's time. There are a lot of them. A lot of them end up with a default judgment, which means that there wasn't even a hearing. The person doesn't respond. Some of those are for cities, city tickets, and many, of course, are from state agencies. Law enforcement can file those, or fish and game brown shirts, I think they're called. And then about a quarter of our caseload is civil and about a quarter criminal. And then if you go to the bottom, you can see the Superior Court filing. So remember, Superior Court can handle all the case types, but the district court has a carve-out of those. So the number, I can go through the numbers. The probate cases, about a third of the caseload, those have been rising steadily over the last decades, possibly due to the aging population. Those do not include just wills, as you might think, but probate is guardianships and conservatorships, which is definitely growing. Mental commitments, will contests, and different types of commitments. The felonies had last year there were 6,736. Those are in 2019 was the highest year at 7,300, but in 2017 there were 6,200. Those just go up and down, and this is well within the normal sort of fluctuation depending on what happens, I suppose. Those do take a lot of time, as you can imagine. They are important. They have to do with liberty interests. There are lots of parties. So that is a substantial amount of a superior court judge's time is handling those felonies. The CINA, Child in Need of Aid cases, which we typically call China cases, are 10% of the filings, but those also are intensely worked by the court system. Again, so many important interests at stake. Like almost everything in the court, but still, when you have children's cases and sometimes needing multiple hearings and a lot of very weighty questions. The domestic relations at the bottom, that would be a divorce with just property division or child custody cases or paternity or other things like that. Many of those hang around until the child is 18 with motions that come after a custody determination. So the probate generally going up, the domestic relations have been going down. We don't know if people are getting along better. We don't have reasons for our data, but those cases have been going down a little bit each year, and the felonies is within the normal fluctuation range. The Superior Court has exclusive jurisdiction. That is, the district court cannot handle these child in need of aid cases, the domestic relations, and the most of the probate matters. The district court filings, 84,000 district court cases, to finally get to Madam Chair's question, is within the general fluctuation. They've gone down gradually over the last 5 years. They might go up. To be specific, the minor offenses, it's almost even hard to count those. They were down tremendously during the pandemic. The theory is that people weren't driving as many places, so didn't get as many tickets. I don't know. The misdemeanors, they have gone down over the past 5 years. One of the reasons might be the way that the different way that this legislature has categorized crimes in the years since SB 91. Things were misdemeanors and became violations under SB 91. That is, they were lowered, so those things would move into that lower category. And certain crimes were authorized to be charged as a new case, and then the prosecution just started to file those as an additional charge in an existing case. So there's lots of reasons those have decreased, but not necessarily meaning that there's less work involved by the agencies and the court system. So misdemeanors generally are something that's punishable by a year or less in prison, and felony is more than a year in prison. The other categories, the civil protective orders, that's your DV or stalking protective orders, and those generally get filed in district court, although those courts have concurrent jurisdiction, so a person can file them any place that they want to file those. Those also have gone up and down. This year it's higher than last year, but not as high as the years before. So generally we think of that as steady. And if are there more questions about those numbers on the chart?
Yes, Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lawyer who handles, you mentioned the probate court filings and the obviously substantial percentage of the Superior Court caseload that those cases represent. A lawyer who works exclusively with wills, trusts, and estates has reported to me that that there have been substantial difficulties in the administration of those cases that he has had experience with in the probate courts. He attributed that in recent years that this problem has arisen to a lack turnover and a resulting lack of institutional knowledge, and that has made the lives of his clients and the beneficiaries, heirs, harder. And I'm just wondering, could you describe how effects of turnover rates or staff cuts have affected operations of the court system?
Through the chair to Representative Grow, I'm not familiar with that. You may or may not know the actual number of will contests is not terribly high. Attorneys who work in wills and estates spend most of their time pre-planning, so there won't be such a contest later. I mean, generally, if somebody is saying the court system isn't as efficient as it used to be or could be more so, we have cut our number of staff over the years, beginning in about 2015, some voluntarily coming to the legislature and say, here's the way our branch can save the state money. Some things happen when you cut your staff. Cases might not be posted in court view as quickly. The data entry might not be made as quickly. I think that our judicial officers have been very busy, but I don't know that it's more busy since 2015 than it was before. I guess it's hard for me to answer without something specific about why a case might be delayed. I haven't heard that case processing is slowed because of a court staff cut. Again, we've had the same judges. We hold the hearings when the parties ask. There are a lot of reasons that hearings get delayed, but it's not because the court says we can't be there. There have been very few instances, but there have been instances of not having a court clerk available to have a hearing. When that happens, it's big news in the court system, and our administrative director and others work together to say we can't be the reason that happens. But if I could be more specific about a case, I'd be happy to, but that's just a generalized response.
Oh, thank you.
And we will be receiving more specific updates during budget subcommittee on some of the changes that were implemented this last year and ongoing with the court system of making Friday afternoons available again, getting more staff back to full time, and that may be a partial answer to your question. And that will be coming soon in subcommittee. The question that I have before you get going on the presentation again is, looking at these numbers, can you give us an idea, and I'm going to test your knowledge here, kind of where we sit on the national averages? I'm looking at 10% China cases. Is that common, or are we higher in that area or in others compared to the national average?
To the chair, I cannot say what national averages are. Because of the way that other states have their court systems set up, it is, it's always apples to bananas when I try to see, and I always understand, I want to know too, but I'm not very successful at finding out how other states' caseloads work. They call them different things, they categorize things in different ways, there are sub-courts, and I'm afraid that I don't know the answer to that question.
I appreciate that. Any other questions? Representative Allard.
Thank you. So going back to what Representative Groh had said, are you stating that there is no backlog in the court systems due to staffing or any other lack of attorneys, lack of clerks, lack of anything? You're saying there's no backlog at all due to the court system's employment?
Through the chair to Representative Allard, there is a criminal case backlog, and there's always, it depends on your definition of backlog, there's always many, many pending cases because cases get filed every day. What we aim for and have always aimed for is a clearance rate is what it's called, kind of the number of filings in a particular area equal to the number of dispositions or closed cases in a certain area. That has, over the years, been pretty close. We aim for that 100% clearance rate. Through the pandemic in particular, we were not able to achieve that.
And that, it, and I'll talk specifically about criminal cases, which might be your focus. But in criminal cases, we do have a backlog, and we have an unacceptably high backlog. It's less this year than it was a year ago today, January of 23. So that's because we are trying to be aggressive about it. And jury trials resumed last year, about a year ago right now, and that is helping. And I mean, I can talk about criminal cases specifically now, if that's appropriate.
Follow-up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out, the numbers of where were we at with criminal cases in 2018? Then we had the pandemic happen. Now where are we at with the backlog due to staffing?
Through the chair to Representative Ellard, I want to clarify that the backlog is not due to staffing. The backlog is due to the fact that cases were not closing in its typical manner. And what I can say, and again, I'll talk about criminal and criminal cases, felonies and misdemeanors. Typically, so we do have a backlog of about 17,000 cases, which is unacceptable. Before the pandemic, the backlog was in the range of 10,000 cases. But we didn't use the word backlog. We just said the number of pending cases. That's what we look at. How many open criminal cases do we have? So we have 7,000 open criminal cases right now, about. In 2019, we had 4,700. So it's gone up, and that's what everybody in the system is trying to address. Pending misdemeanors in 2019 were 8,200. Now there's 10,500. So it's definitely increased. What I want to say is that it's not due to lack of staffing.
Okay.
It's part of it was definitely the, well, it was the pandemic stalling certain things from happening. So in criminal cases, we always kept hearing emergency issues from day one. The court never closed down for emergencies. And then other cases got added that were conducted remotely or other hearings. But that took a little bit of time to ensure that everybody had access, everybody had the right screens and video, as everybody in the country was struggling with. It was hard to get some parts, et cetera. Even though criminal cases dispose in different ways than you might think, our felony jury trial rate has consistently been no higher than 2.5%. So no higher, more than 2.5% of these cases ever went to jury trial. It might have gotten up to 4% or so in the 2000s, but you know, certainly no higher than 4%, generally about 2.5%. Misdemeanor trial rate is more like 1%. So when you look at all those misdemeanor cases, 18,000 of them, you would expect only 1% to ever go to a jury trial. So what happens? Well, in FY22, the felonies that were dismissed, that is just dismissed outright, 40% of those. The other 58% were closed as a result of a plea bargain, which means a guilty plea. So in some ways, it's been puzzling why, just because there were no jury trials, there wouldn't still be all those dismissals, which are largely by the prosecutor, by the way. This is not the court dismissing cases. This is the prosecutor generally, except for a handful, dismissing cases, or why plea bargains weren't pursued. The only explanation in talking to the agencies why might this happen is without a trial date on their calendars, the parties who had their own struggles and challenges with the pandemic were not picking up the file and addressing the case they would have in the same manner they would have had they known, oh my gosh, we're on trial this July. Let me pick up this file. Let me make a plea offer to the other side, or let me look and realize, well, I don't have the strength of the case that I thought, so I will dismiss it. So those cases built. And now that we're back to having jury trials, or the more important thing is having jury trials scheduled, the cases are disposing now at a higher rate. Our plea bargains have gone up, and that's the way we're whittling down at that backlog.
So I have a
follow-up, Representative.
Thank you. I do have a quick question. So Representative Vance already mentioned that maybe Fridays. If we look at opening up Fridays again, are we talking about being able to whittle down the amount of cases aren't heard?
Through the chair to Representative Vance, we're now open in all the larger courts on Friday afternoons and in many, many of the smaller courts. The level of service being offered in those courts is different. The customer service is open so that you can walk in and file something or get a copy or pay your fine or pay your bail in about, I have the list, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I'm going to say 20 of our courts. Okay, certainly all the bigger ones. The Friday afternoons for jury trial time has, in Anchorage, for example, the jury trial day is 8:30 to 1:30. And then in the afternoon, the judges and the parties do their, you know, other cases or have hearings or something like that. So the Friday afternoons, A, it's coming on board and is pretty strong already. But I don't know that Friday afternoons would hurry along the criminal trial disposition rate. And if it would, we would be doing it because it's frustrating to everyone.
One more follow-up, Representative Allard?
I apologize. Okay, so you're saying right now we're at averaging about we normally average just over 4,000 criminal cases. We're at about 7,000 now. Is that, did I hear that correctly? I think that's what I had on my notes.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, that was the felony number?
Yes. Okay, so you're at 4,700, but right now we're averaging about 7,000. So with the with the Friday's opening, I guess I'm trying to figure out how long until you guys are going to be able, the court systems are going to be able to bring it back down to the 4,700.
Through the chair to Representative Vance, I don't know the answer, but
okay.
I also want to say that that is, I know the justice system is the court system in many people's minds, but it is a large interrelated web of the public defenders who themselves have struggles, the district attorney's office who struggles, the municipal attorney's office when it comes to misdemeanors. We're talking crime lab involvement, travel issues for experts. So we are trying. I think everyone's trying. Nobody likes to have cases pending for a long time. But it's something that, you know, our presiding judges meet with the prosecutors and PDs on to see what we can do to move it along. There are working groups on moving cases forward, and I don't know when it will happen.
Okay. Fair enough.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you touched on my question a minute ago, which is based on the graph here, the chart. This is a listing of the filings. I'm wondering if we could get a chart that shows it's the same headings and same topics in the charts, but with the time that it took to get cases disposed, I think is what you called them. So what is the current time to get things disposed in each one of those categories? That kind of gives us an understanding of where the biggest delays are happening at. Like, I don't know whether a probate case takes longer than a minor offense. And that might be a bad example. Maybe I would assume that minor offenses are disposed of quicker than a probate is, but I don't know that. So I'm trying to just wrap my head around this is what's the input. This is what's being filed. Where's the output and where's the delay? That's what I'm trying to see a picture of. You were just talking about that there's a lot of moving pieces here. Maybe the data isn't being collected. That might be part of the issue here. I know that the court system is dealing with court cases, and I don't know whether you've got people that are collecting data to look inward at where the delay is happening at. So I guess That's what I'm trying to understand is where do we focus?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, I don't believe we have data on the time to disposition average for a probate case. I don't know that it would be that helpful because some cases are easy and they'll be fast, and some cases have many parties and many issues and they would be slow. We have collected data on what we call TTD, the time to disposition for criminal cases, because that's what a lot of people are interested in. I don't know that we've done that in the last year or two, and I almost, you know, what it would show is in the last year or two is not normal because things didn't move along over the years. But I think if I'm going by memory now, but I think people are always surprised at the number of cases that resolve very, very quickly. Felonies too. So when I say they get dismissed or plea bargained, many, many of those happened right away, within days, within a month of being filing. What you are, and I can find data, but what we have is cases resolved within a month, cases resolved within a year. And then you hear about the outliers, those 12 felony cases that took 5 years to get to disposition. And that is, again, frustrating to everybody. But I know we have some of those. And again, I'm going to sort of blame the system or just say it's because of all the parties and moving pieces involved. Those would be homicide cases. Those would have DNA analyses. Those would have multiple experts flying in from outside. But I can get some time to disposition on criminal and misdemeanor cases. It will not be immediate, but I can get that for you. Yes.
Follow up.
Thank you. You'd referenced that 10,000, I think, was the number that you used of cases previous to the pandemic. Was that number accurate in the backlog, which is not really a backlog, it's just how many cases, how many filings?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, that's about how many pending. What I have is a snapshot on January 1st of the last many years, how many cases were pending, felony, misdemeanor, and then combined. Yes, about 10,000. It was 9,600 in 2018.
And so the direction that I'm heading here is to try to understand what the length of time for those cases are in these categories, and then to understand where the delay is being caused. Because it's not staff at the court system. It's some other thing that's causing the delay that may or may not have a legislative solution, but I don't see where that delay is. And that's what I'm trying to understand.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, there is definitely delay in criminal and misdemeanor cases. A lot of it happens because the agencies cannot be ready for trial because they are understaffed or overworked. So if you have a hearing scheduled and the agencies, by which I mean the district attorney's office and the public defenders who represent the vast number of people in these cases, comes in and says, my predecessor just quit, and I just was handed this case, and it's 6 file boxes. I can't go to trial next month. I need some time. That happens. It happens a lot. And that is a delay, right? But what, there is no other option. So some of it is that sort of thing. Some of it is the prosecutor coming in. I know we have a trial date on February 1st, Your Honor, but the crime lab hasn't gotten me the analysis yet. I need a delay until at least August. They're backed up. So our time to disposition won't tell you that. Again, there are different work groups, the UAA Justice Center, the Criminal Justice Working Group, who are all trying to do what you're trying to do, and that is find out why and what can be done to fix it. The why is, to be just blunt about it, a lack of millions and millions and millions of dollars in resources for all those agencies so that the public defender doesn't say, I have a conflict. I can't go to trial in February because I have to be in trial in Sitka in February. And if there were more bodies, I suppose no one would be asking that. But that isn't feasible. And so the agencies do their very best. Some of them are short-staffed, I know for a fact, both the DAs and public defenders. And so that is sort of one of the reasons for delay. But that could be really the topic for a whole hearing, it seems to me. There are a lot of people working on the issue.
Follow-up?
Yeah, and I guess more of a statement than a... You've been here since I've been first elected, and I think you've been in your position for a number of years, and I undoubtedly know that you know what you're talking about. What I'm looking for is data. And if the other agencies that you referenced who've been studying the problem have the data, then that's probably where I need to go to get it. But anecdotal or opinion is not as helpful as being able to see data that's collected that helps us see where the problem is. And that, so that's kind of where I'm headed. Thank you.
Well, and we will be receiving some overviews from the Department of Law, where in subcommittee we have addressed this specific issue. And I appreciate Ms. Mead's, you know, vast knowledge of, from the court's perspective, there are many moving pieces, and we would appreciate if you do have any more detailed data on the court specifically for the committee, that would be helpful. But to address Representative Carpenter's question, one of the things that we addressed last year specifically in the Department of Law that gave me a better understanding is that more than 50% of the state's attorneys have less than 5 years experience, if I remember correctly. And therefore, as Ms. Mead explained, they get new cases. It takes a longer amount of time to go through a case than an experienced attorney would have previously addressed. And so that in itself is one issue. They've adjusted recruitment and trying to have be able to get new great minds into the state. And it's not just a money issue. It's a matter of these people being available to do the work. But I do appreciate, from the court's perspective, trying to answer the questions. And we will get into the Friday staffing and that process so that members can get up to speed at another time. But I believe Representative Eastman is next in the queue.
Thank you. Could you restate the number of cases that are currently backlog status?
On January 1st of 2023, and again, backlog is, you know, people ask the backlog. The only way I know is how many cases are open. We had about 7,200 open felony cases and 10,500 open misdemeanors for a total of 17,700.
Okay. And obviously we've had, you know, right to a speedy trial guidelines in place for some number of years. How many of those cases reflect you know, individuals where the speedy trial guidelines have either been exceeded or been waived based on the amount of time those cases have been in process?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, the speedy trial rule, not merely a guideline, is 120 days. It is routinely waived by the defendant. And so out of those 17,000 cases, how many were filed within the last 4 months? I don't know, but the vast majority would be older. Well, the majority would be older than 4 months old.
Okay. And of those 17,700 cases, how many of them involve someone in pretrial custody?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, I don't have that data, and the court system doesn't have that data.
Okay.
Follow up, Representative Eastman?
Yes, please. Thank you. And in the case where someone hasn't waived their 120 days, how many cases are we talking about where the defendant has not waived and yet we're still past it?
Through the chair, if the rule 45, which is our 120-day rule, has run without the defendant waiving it, the case must be dismissed. So virtually none.
And why do we say virtually? Is there some exceptions out there?
I think last year, the number of cases dismissed for a Rule 45 violation, I can tell you, is, I say virtually because it's one.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Through the chair, I was just curious. I understand that you try to have it balanced, that, you know, it's not a backlog, it's just how many are open, and that you try to have a certain number of dismissed as a certain number of filed. Do we know, like, what the average number of cases being filed in a week is and the average number of cases being, being disposed of in a week is, or by months? Like, I feel like that would be helpful data for me to kind of understand what's going on.
Yes, we have it by year. I'm not sure if our data, I'm sorry, through the chair to Representative Gray, I'm not sure if our data person can split it out by week or month. I also want to say that the court system has a robust website. Its annual reports, in fact, all of them for about the past at least 15 years, are posted on there. I use mine all the time, and you could find information there. I'm not putting you off in any sense, but if I'm not available, that's one place you could go. But we have charts about the clearance rates of criminal cases and of other cases as well. I can follow up with charts of the clearance rates for criminal cases. Follow up?
No, thank you for going down this rabbit hole with us.
And let the record reflect that at 1:39 p.m., Representative Johnson joined us. Please proceed with your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just mention a few other things about crimes and felonies and misdemeanors. And maybe I won't do it unless there's a question, but if people on the committee ever wonder, like, what generally is a felony and misdemeanor and what the penalties, the jail time possible is, I could go through that if Madam Chair wants, or I could save it and just see if there's a question about it. Want me to start going fast and see if it's worth it?
Please proceed. I'm sure we will have many questions as you go along.
Okay. I just, if you're not terribly familiar with criminal law, and I know that some of the folks on the committee are new, it might be just helpful to have in your head the picture of the felony levels and the misdemeanor levels. So the felonies, there are four levels: unclassified, and those would mostly be your murders, sexual assault of a minor in the first, unclassified, and then below that is Class A, Class B, and Class C. That's it for felonies. And then there's the line, the dividing line. And then you have A misdemeanors and less severe are B misdemeanors. I'll start with the misdemeanors because it's easiest. An A misdemeanor is punishable by up to a year in jail. There are a lot of exceptions, but that's generally how you can think of it. A B misdemeanor is 0 to 90 days in jail. There are fines that are possible for all of these if convicted as well. A B misdemeanor is a fine of up to $2,000 and an A misdemeanor up to $25,000. It's extremely rare to get a big fine like that, if ever, because if the defendant has an inability to pay it, it is not considered terribly just to impose a fine like that. For felonies, your unclassifieds, they're punishable by between 5 and 99 years in prison. You often hear of 99 years somebody gets for murder, and that's because that's your statutory limit. All of these penalties are set out in AS 1255, 125 for felonies, and 1255, 135 for misdemeanors. The felony ones are very complicated. I think your statute runs about 6 pages in the book, and that's because there are a lot of subsections and a lot of exceptions. And these are just for your crimes in Title 11. An A misdemeanor is 0 to 20 years with your first time presumptively 4 to 7. So what your statute has is the overall 0 to 20 years, and then it will have presumptive ranges. That is, this is where it should fall unless there's a statutory, you set these aggravators, meaning you can go above it, or mitigators, meaning the judge can go below it. Okay, so 4 to 7 is your typical first-time presumptive range of sentences, time in jail for a first-time A misdemeanor, and then the statute goes on. Second time is 10 to 14, third time is 15 to 20. B misdemeanors are 0 to 10, first time presumptively 1 through 3.
Do you mean felony?
You mean felony?
I'm sorry?
Say that again.
Would you...
Did I misstate something? Okay. Let me say, now I'm into B felonies. I'm sorry if I misspoke. B felonies, 0 to 10 years, 1 to 3 your first time, 3 to 7, 6 to 10. Again, those are the presumptive things. And then C felonies, 0 to 5 years with 0 to 2 for your first time, 2 to 4, and then 3 to 5. And fines, again, can be assessed, but are not terribly often assessed. The sex offenses have their own specific penalties. Fish and game has its own specific penalties. DUI has its own specific penalties. So coming up with one chart of all penalties, the one that our judges use is about 12 pages long. And that's like a cheat sheet that has all the statutory sites, and then they'll have their statute book and then know exactly where to go for all these different penalties. So it's not super straightforward. Obviously, there's probation. You have mandated certain minimum and maximum probations for all these levels of offenses as well. Okay, so that was just like a quick one on criminal penalties. Going back to sort of the court overall, I also want to mention that the court, unlike the executive branch agencies, does not have any regulations. Regulations are substantive law. You pass the statute and authorize agencies to do it. But what we do have is constitutional authority, a requirement actually in the Constitution to adopt rules of practice and procedure. This is the annual Alaska Rules of Court. It's very thick, because there are rules on everything you can imagine, from the timing, how to get your case dismissed, what to file. They're procedural. They are not substantive. To pass these, the Supreme Court has a very active system of rules committees. There are 7 rules committees: appellate, child in need of aid, civil rules committee, criminal rules committee, probate rules committee, et cetera. Made up of subject matter experts. For example, the Criminal Rules Committee, I think, has 5 judges, 4 defense-oriented attorneys, and 4 prosecution-oriented attorneys who can get in a room and hash out the issues because they know what's going on and what the procedure should be to implement, I guess, the substantive laws that you pass. Other than, you know, case filings and kind of trial court operations and appellate court operations that you might think of, the court system has a self-help center. More and more people handle their own cases without an attorney. The self-represented persons often need some sort of guidance. We have hundreds of simplified forms that they can fill out. We have videos online, what to expect in your case and how to file this in your case. We have an 800, I don't know if it's still that, a toll-free phone number where people can call and get assistance. We have law library.
I apologize. I was waiting till you finished your. Oh, took a breath. We have a question from Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was content to let her finish as well. But the further you went, the further away the question was going to be relevant. So the question is regarding the process for amending or changing your court rules. I understand from previous legislatures that there's a committee process there. I'm curious to know if the recent changes to Rule 6 and 6.1 followed the committee process?
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, and for context, the Supreme Court recently, when they change a rule, they pass a Supreme Court order changing the rule. They recently amended the rule with respect to grand juries in a Supreme Court order that was effective on December 1st of 2022 that I know that you're referring to. That rule change itself did not go through the Criminal Rules Committee, but it is going through it now. So the court made changes and then sent the rule changes and everything else to the Criminal Rules Committee to assess whether further changes should be made, different changes, or what have you. So it's on their agenda for their next meeting, and so that was passed in a different manner, which is authorized, because at the time there were different proceedings going on around the state with respect to grand juries that were varying in how they were done. There were not enough procedures here, because up until about a year ago, it was an extremely rarely used process, and nobody identified that there was a gap. Once 3 different cases, one in Juneau, one in Kenai, one in Anchorage, cropped up on something, the Supreme Court saw that it should act more rapidly than not in order to make the process efficient and consistent. But again, it'll go to the Criminal Rules Committee, or it is there now.
Follow-up? And thank you. And very quickly, can you provide me with the reference to the process that allows the Supreme Court to change the rules and then put it to the committee? And it doesn't have to be today. You could get it back. I just want to be able to educate myself on that, kind of a reverse process.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, it's Administrative Rule 44, which is entitled Rulemaking, and it has in there an exception that the court used to adopt rules because there was a little bit of a mess. And so it deemed that it needed to do this right away to help out the judges and the parties understand how it should go.
Okay, thank you.
So back to, thank you for that. Back to your discussion about the tools available to the public. I have noticed that there is more information on social media, especially Facebook, that is helpful to people to kind of wade through the court system. And so I just want to thank you for that. And if you could just state some of the resources available again to the public to help them, because it is an overwhelming process.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, if you follow the Alaska court system on Twitter or follow their Facebook page, you will get a lot of information. We offer family law self-help mostly, and that is because a lot of people in family law, divorces or custody cases, opt not to go through the process with an attorney for their reasons, which are probably mostly financial. And we offer hundreds of forms that they can use to get their issue addressed by the court. We have an 800 phone, a toll-free phone line that's open most days. I don't know their exact schedule, but it's also on our website that you can just call and say, look, this is happening. What do I file? How do I get something done? That is all procedural guidance. It is not legal advice. We can't offer legal advice to people. We have videos, how your divorce will proceed, and they're all available on our website. For probate, more and more people probate their own estates. There's a lot of information about how to do that, how to be a guardian or conservative. There are professional guardians and conservators and agency ones, but there are also many family members who become the guardian or conservator, for example, for an elderly parent. There are requirements, statutory requirements for filing reports or whatnot, and that's all included on our website. There's small claims information, housing information. For housing, we have a new eviction diversion program, and there's a landlord-tenant dispute where we, if they want, we will offer some sort of mediation, telling the tenant where to get assistance, and helping the parties just come to a resolution that's you know, mutually satisfactory. We even have FAQs on what if I don't pay my traffic ticket? What about this? What about that? So it is on our website under representing yourself, and it's a very strong program and has actually received national awards for how much help it gives individuals. Anyhow, I was going to say we also have law libraries, and they will do research by phone or by email request, as well as being open in person in several communities. Other than that, we have the normal things you would think of in the court system, fiscal department and HR and all those. I'll jump to therapeutic courts, which is one of the programs I think legislators have a lot of interest in. I provided a chart of where we have therapeutic courts and what type of defendant those serve. So we have them in six different locations: Anchorage, Palmer, Kenai, Juneau, Sitka, and Fairbanks. You can see it on the chart. And within those locations, we have Anchorage has 6 different types of therapeutic courts. So what these are is an alternative approach to getting through a criminal case with treatment. They're a diversionary program. The defendant must opt in. We don't force defendants to go through them. And then once a defendant opts in and everybody involved agrees that they're an appropriate candidate for the program, a plea agreement is negotiated. For example, the person will say, I plead guilty, and if I don't make it through the program, I know I'll go to jail for a year or two, depending on the level of severity and what gets negotiated. So they then enter the structured program with that sentence deferred until and hopefully if they finish the program. If they drop out or are terminated, that sentence is imposed. The program uses incentives and sanctions to encourage compliance. It's very intense. For the first week, they meet with a team of about 8 or 10 people every week, including the judge. There is treatment, there is housing, and there are jobs, and the person goes through at least 18 months of this program and emerges at the end with a graduation, and then that person, studies have shown, recidivates or reoffends at a much lower rate than if they had not gone through the program. Some people do drop out. Sometimes, depending on the snapshot, you might see 50% of the people dropping out. Sometimes zero people drop out. It's very intense, and people have to want to go through all that treatment. And it is the team approach with the DA, public defender, probation officer, treatment providers, judge, all coordinating together to address that person's underlying issues that cause them to enter the criminal justice system. And we want to stop that cycle, the revolving door that some individuals find themselves in because of an underlying either mental health disorder, substance abuse disorder most commonly.
So do you know what the success rate is of the therapeutic courts versus those who do not take advantage of this? Do you have any specific numbers?
I do not at my fingertip. And through to the chair, I think you mean the recidivism rate. Those who reoffend afterwards, I could go by my memory, but I better get that data and provide it to the committee. It's on the order of, you know, I've heard 60% of people who don't go through therapeutic courts reoffend, and this would be on the order of half of that.
Well, and I see that we have, a limited number of capacity. Do you know if these numbers are at capacity every year? And the other question is at the very bottom where it says Sitka has a NA on there instead of the number, and if you could explain that of why there isn't a capacity number for Sitka.
To the chair, I'll answer your second question first. That court began less than a year ago, and a capacity hasn't been set because we aren't sure how many people will be wanting it, so it's flexible at this point. I will say for the therapeutic courts, they have been traditionally undersubscribed, to many people's surprise. Only right now, and I have, I get a monthly report, right now two of the courts, Fairbanks Wellness and Anchorage Veteran Courts, are oversubscribed, and that means they have 27 people with a max capacity of 25, so not by a lot. All the other ones are under their capacity. The reason for that is sometimes puzzling, but the reason is a lot of defendants don't want to go into this program. This is very intense. If you get a DUI and you have to spend even a felony DUI, and the punishment is 4 months in jail, many, many people prefer to do 4 months in jail than to spend 18 months under the thumb of a probation officer and judge breathing down their throats. Secondly, the person has to want to do treatment. It is not for everybody. They aren't at the stage of their life where they believe this will be productive for them or helpful to them. It's a terrific program for the right individuals. That is somebody who, for example, has gone through treatment before and failed, or has so many crimes and they have probation violations, they're just unable to get out of this cycle. But for example, a first-time misdemeanor DUI wouldn't really benefit from 18 months of intensive treatment, probably, because that doesn't necessarily indicate an underlying substance abuse issue, necessarily. Or certain drug people don't want anything to do with sticking with the court for 18 months. So the individual has to be the right type of person who would benefit from such a program. And unless there are more incentives, several years ago the legislature added that with participation in therapeutic court, there could be an avenue to getting a limited driver's license back after a DUI. And that did motivate more people because typically, well, by statute, if somebody has a felony DUI, they lose their license for life, which is very difficult. And so that person might be motivated with some avenue back. So that was helpful. But still, the courts are not overly subscribed.
Do you know if there's been a cost-benefit analysis on the use of therapeutic courts?
To the chair, that is actually something that the, I want to say the Judicial Council, which does studies, might have done, but I'm not certain. Certainly the cost per participant is not low, and the cost, well, it's high, but the legislature and others in the system have thought, yes, but that person probably won't come back and cost the system money in other ways. So it's a difficult number to assess. So in other words, even if you see it, you don't know how that compares to not going through therapeutic court. But I do believe there is at least one study where they tried to do it. It's very difficult because you have the way therapeutic courts are set up. It's all in the court system's budget, by the way, and then money gets RSA'd. You could take, you know, if there are 25 people in the court, do you take 1/25th of the prosecutor's time? Oh, wait, but he or she does other cases as well. It's a very difficult number to pin down. However, we have a budget. All of therapeutic courts is in the same budget unit, so you will see a global number for it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions before she proceeds?
Okay. And I am actually finished with my prepared material. I'd be happy to answer any other questions related to our operations.
Representative Eastman.
Just to clarify, when you talk about oversubscribed, are we talking about over an ideal number, and so there's inefficiencies, or are we talking about somebody on a waiting list?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, we do not have a waiting list. Those people are in the court, but maybe the courtroom's crowded, or maybe the judge has to stay for 2 hours and 20 minutes instead of going, you know, finishing in 2 hours. So a couple of those courts, as I mentioned, are over capacity, but we are handling it.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
I'll save it for another day.
Since we have a little bit more time, if you have it in your calendar to stay a little bit longer, would you go ahead and speak to some of the changes about the Fridays being opened and the staff, simply because everyone's eager to get the information. If you could go ahead and provide that, I think that would help in understanding the efforts that the courts are making to be open to the public.
Thank you to the chair. I am sure my colleague will do a better job of this as you intimated during the subcommittee process. But I know that we transition. For background, back in 2016, the courts closed on Friday afternoons, and the savings to the state was about $2 million, and that was because all of our employees took a 4% pay cut. So they couldn't work if they wanted to Friday afternoons. Everyone had to take that 4% pay cut, and that represented the loss of hours worked. And the reason it was just 4% is because we added on a half hour Monday through Thursday. So employees for the judicial branch were working 36 hours. Well, I should say we're paid for 36 hours rather than the typical state work week of 37.5. And again, the court proposed that as a cost savings measure. And I will also add that it was very popular with the agencies, with the Office of Children's Services, the district attorney, and the public defenders and other agencies involved with the court, because they had afternoon time, Friday afternoons, when they knew that they wouldn't be called into court and they could get other types of work done. The court held committee meetings that afternoon. The judges were not excused Friday afternoon. They stayed in and got what's called desk time and worked on their orders. But the other employees did get excused at noon. That was very effective. And then in the last few years, legislators and some others started to wish we were open Friday afternoon. And as a result, we started just last year with additional funding, and I want to say we got $1 million, but Mr. Wolliver will be correcting me, to start gradually making employees who had been on that 36-hour, asking them to transition back up to 37.5 hours. And today, every new employee that we hire is a 37.5 hour because they do have to work Friday afternoons. So some could opt to add that back on and get the extra 4% pay. And now all new hires, again, are on that afternoon. So we have the front counter open for for basic customer service that people walk into the courtroom for. We are holding some hearings on Friday afternoons. We don't have trials on Friday afternoons, at least in Anchorage, but the judge can opt to continue into Friday afternoons because now there are some staff in the building. And sometimes if the attorneys so request, that can happen. So I don't know if that answered it. I could tell you which courts have it. I have that list, but the extent is it's good now and it's growing as we hire more people to cover that. And those on 36 hours are fewer, a lower and lower percentage of our workforce.
Thank you. Question from Representative Ballard.
Thank you. So you're saying it's cost effective because we cut $2 million, but then you have individuals that are lingering, I can't even say the word, in the system. So even though if you're cutting $2 million, there's somewhere in there where being delayed and in the system is actually ends up not being cost effective. So when we're not hearing cases or moving things forward on the Fridays at a full speed ahead, 5 days a week, all day long, we could literally cut the delay down.
Through the chair to Representative Allard, that is a question, because on Friday afternoons, we are still handling quite a few things. Judges are faster at getting their written products out. The hearings in the Friday morning are very, very much faster. I guess that was the question back in 2016 when the budget cut was welcomed by the legislature because there was a little bit of a crisis. It was deemed that the balance was in favor of, look, get rid of Friday afternoons for customer service. How much of a slowdown will it actually cost? Remember, we added a half hour onto the day, so it really was only a couple of hours of less staff time for case processing. But in recognition of that point of view, Representative Allard, the legislature started to say, okay, now give it back. We got, I think, $1 million thereabouts last year to start to segue back into it. And that is where we are headed because of that very concern.
Thank you. Just a little. It's more of a statement, but yeah, I just find customer service is what needs to happen. So when I can't go in on a Friday because I might have a work schedule that's not working or conducive to the other 4 days a week, I'm all for just full speed ahead, 40 hours a week or whatever we're allowed. I guess it's 37.5. Okay.
We get to address that very budget item in subcommittee,
okay.
And I think they will welcome your excitement.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, thank you, Ms. Mead, for coming and answering a variety of questions. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is not a question, it may be a request. You mentioned that the judges have a 12-sheet cheat sheet on misdemeanors and the rankings and what that is. Is that an internal document, or is there any way I could get a copy of it, or the committee could get a copy of it? Because I think that kind of stuff, we how many questions have we already had about sentencing and misdemeanors? So is that something that we could get a copy of for either the committee room or individually to be able to do our own research instead of having to ask the same question over and over and over?
Through the chair to Representative Johnson, I shouldn't have mentioned that sheet because I actually prepare it, and it is considered attorney work product. And the reason I don't publicize, I'm not hiding anything. All it is a summary of your very statutes. Your ledge legal could do it in a format that you want. But I don't publicize it because it could be wrong. This is my read of the statutes, and it has I'm confident that it's very helpful to the judges, but the materials I prepare for judges for their use on the bench is considered our internal work product.
We can accommodate that request, Representative Johnson.
I think, Madam Chair, once again, you know, somebody has control of that. Someone can release that attorney. Would you explore the possibilities just for my personal keeping our legal department from having to redo it? Just a yes or no would be fine. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the eagerness to learn and understand the system because, as we've heard, there is so much to the entire judicial system. We appreciate your presentation. And
I believe that Ms. Mead is available. You see her in the hallways and always takes time to answer our questions on an individual basis. So thank you for that. This concludes our business for today. Our next committee hearing will be on Wednesday, February 3rd. And the committee will be given an overview of operations and current statistics from the Alaska Department of Corrections. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 2:10 p.m.